Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
Celebrating holidays in space, plus a new telescope aims to bring a fresh perspective of our galaxy. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Burr. How do you celebrate holidays in space? Astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station celebrate a little differently than we do here on Earth. From freeze-dried Thanksgiving meals to rocket-delivered Christmas gifts, there are a lot of ways people still create their holiday traditions in orbit. We'll speak with veteran NASA astronaut Nicole Stott about how she spent the holidays off Earth. Then a new telescope will bring a fresh perspective of our galaxy. NASA finished building the Roman Space Telescope, a giant scope that will search for things like exoplanets and observe millions of stars. We'll speak with NASA's Joshua Schlieder about the telescope, its capabilities, and future exploring our universe. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? From costumes made of trash to freeze-dried Thanksgiving meals, space travelers on the International Space Station have come up with unique ways to celebrate the holidays over the years. The astronauts of Apollo 8 celebrated Christmas as they circled the moon in 1968, famously reading passages from the Bible which were broadcast back to Earth. Now, decades later, astronauts continue to find fun ways to celebrate the holidays, from presents to unique pumpkin carvings. The celebrations continue in orbit. Here to talk about how she celebrated holidays on the International Space Station is veteran NASA astronaut, aquanaut, and artist Nicole Stott. Nicole, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
It's nice to be here. It's always a pleasure.
Always fun to have you. And we're here to talk about something fun, talking about celebrations in space. You know, this interview is airing around the week of Christmas. You were up in space for more than 100 days. What did you celebrate up there? Any holidays while you were in space?
Yeah, I don't think you can spend 100 days anywhere without overlapping a holiday.
That's true.
Quite honestly, you know, when we're in space, I think we're celebrating the whole time the fact that we even get to be in that extraordinary place and experience that and live and work there. But I had Halloween and I had Thanksgiving and I had a birthday and, you know, and other people's birthdays. And of course, we always try to prepare in case we end up there a little bit longer. So I had a bunch of stuff packed for Christmas as well.
Let's start chronologically and start with Halloween. How did you spend your Halloween on the International Space Station?
Halloween was fun. You know, I didn't pack, you know, kind of a bespoke costume or anything. And the crew as a whole, we pretty much scavenged from around the station and put together our costumes. And we did. I made a like a ballerina skirt out of this thermal cover from the HTV, that Japanese cargo vehicle. It's this cover that covered up the hatch. And it was gorgeous. It was this copper, long flowing skirt looking thing. But we scavenged to come up with our costumes, and we made a point of communicating with the ground about it. We wanted to know that they were having costumes in mission control that day. And we had a whole conversation with them. There was a spare orange that probably wasn't in good, I don't know, we just found it. It would not have been in good shape to eat. So we carved like a little pumpkin looking thing out of this orange. But it was so much fun because we knew there were pumpkin carving contest going on with the folks in mission control. We knew they were wearing costumes and we were able to just engage with them that way. I have memories of laughing really, really hard during all of that exchange that was going on.
And do you have to account for that? Like, I know on the ground, NASA wants to know where every single part is and every cataloged and all that stuff. Did you have to report back that you had stolen some things to make your
Well, we liberated temporarily, I guess I would say. You know, like the reason I felt comfortable with the thermal cover for the HTV was that I knew it wasn't being used again, right? It was serving no purpose other than going in the trash. So none of it was operational. But yeah, we do keep track of everything. Whatever we took out, we put back where we got it.
I wonder if on the official archive that your skirt shows up that it was used as spaceflight hardware and then also as a Halloween costume before it was thrown in the trash.
You know, historically, that would be super significant, I'm sure, at least in my own mind. But we do have the photographic evidence. So
excellent. Let's talk about the next holiday, one of my favorites, which is Thanksgiving. How do you prepare for Thanksgiving?
Well, thankfully, the ground is thinking about us all the time. So there was special food packed, you know, and sent Santa for Thanksgiving. You know, it was special in that here's the food items that you would normally kind of eat during Thanksgiving, but it wasn't specially created, I guess. So it was from the same kind of menu or list of items that we already have. But it was nice because, you know, you had the green beans, you know, the little pack of turkey and the mashed potatoes and gravy. And even if you had to rehydrate them, it was kind of cool to just be thinking about it as the celebration we knew we were going to have. And it was fun. I know Jeff and I did a little video downlink with the ground to news folks. Maybe you were there. I don't know, where we were floating the food around and talking about what we were going to have for Thanksgiving and how we were going to celebrate together. And it wasn't, I guess what I like about all of the holidays that we celebrated up there was that just because that's an American thing, we didn't just say, okay, only the U.S. crew members can eat the Thanksgiving meal. It was a way that there where we were just inviting everyone to come together. And I think that's what's so special about the place to begin with. You know, we're up there with this higher mission. We've all agreed upon the rules of engagement to make it happen, and how we eat and celebrate falls into that as well.
Nicole, you returned the day after Thanksgiving, but as you were mentioning to me before we started this conversation, you had planned to be on the International Space Station through the Christmas holiday. What plans went into that? What were you prepared for?
Well, I think that the plan was that you don't know what might happen. As we've seen, you know, in recent times, you don't know what might keep you there longer or, you know, result in a little bit longer stay, which, quite honestly, I wouldn't have been opposed to. The ground teams are so thoughtful, and they're like, yeah, you know, there's every chance Nicole and some other of her crewmates might end up there longer than we're already thinking. And you never know how, and I experienced this, you know, your launch date keeps delaying, right? Which then puts your return date out. And so that launch date could have kept moving, that made me overlap Christmas too. And so I had, you know, I had some gifts from my family, little things that the ground flew up in a care package, these very fun stockings that somebody on the ground team had made, you know, like handmade, these very collapsible, but very thoughtful, personalized stockings to have on board. And while I didn't get to enjoy those in space, because I came home the day after Thanksgiving, I was able to bring them home with me. That stocking went up on Christmas, you know, down here on Earth, which, by the way, we're in space, right? So, you know, we could call it still in space. And it really was this nice connection back to, you know, my friends that I knew were still on the space station, and to the ground team who thinks about us that way.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Nicole Stott. She's an astronaut, aquanaut, and artist. We're talking about celebrating holidays from orbit on the International Space Station. Nicole, I want to talk about connection, because this time of year, sometimes we're not able to spend it with our friends and our family here on Earth. You have experience with that, being in space for over 100 days. How do you maintain that connection when you're in orbit with your family down here on Earth?
Well, I think you have to be purposeful about it, right? You have to be considering that, which I think all of us, I've never met a person flying in space who didn't want to stay connected with their family and friends on Earth, and all the different ways, you know, just whether that's sending a picture to them or recording videos to bring home to your kids, you know, to share with them and your family, or just the daily phone call, right? And what's so great about the way we fly in space as humans, especially on the International Space Station, is that's always been considered from the beginning, is we want our crew members to have that connection with their family and friends, not just talking to mission control and having them liaise with for us, but to have that direct communication. And it's super important to the crew. I mean, when I was there, we had weekly video conferences with our families. And then I could call every day multiple times if I wanted. It was just available. You know, as long as we had the satellite connection, we could phone home. And that has just continued to get better and better. You know, my family, they had to sit in a particular room of the house with the little Polycom thing set up with the camera and the voice deal. And now, you know, my friends are flying in space and their families can take an iPad to the soccer game and they can, you know, see that and talk to their kids and while that's going on. And it just keeps getting better. And And it's very purposely built into the way humans get to live in space, which I think is a really wonderful thing.
And that's often how we are now communicating with our family and friends when we're not there, is our little screens on our phones, right? We're
able to
make that connection.
Yeah. And in feeling comfortable with these alternative ways to speak to each other that sometimes makes us feel further apart, you know, like I want my son to be in the same place as me when I'm talking to him or know that he's, you know, up the road. But if I can communicate with him on this device that allows me to be in contact no matter where he is, how awesome is that? And it allows me to speak to people in ways and engage with them, even visually, you know, through the tech that we have that I never would have when I was a kid, right? And it just seems so normal now that we get to do that.
It's very cool. We're communicating like astronauts when we FaceTime our family.
We are. I mean, I feel like it right now with you, Brendan.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking,
we're not in the same room. Yeah.
You know, are we there yet? We're like not in the same, you know, we're there yet.
Nicole, one final holiday I want to talk about, because I'm extremely curious how this works, is New Year's in space. How would astronauts celebrate New Year's? Do you pick a time zone? I mean, you're circling the Earth at an incredible speed. There's so many New Year's that you get to celebrate, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I think what happens is we're operating to GMT, right? So our timeline is kind of associated, like if you were in London or something. So there's that New Year's Eve. But I think each of us tries to maintain that connection again, tries to maintain our connection to our home, to our families. My family would be in the United States. And so I'd be looking for that time, you know, 5 hours later to call or connect or be looking out at Earth, you know, celebrating New Year's at that point in time. You know, my friends from Europe or, you know, Canada or Russia, they might be looking at it a little bit differently. But it's kind of cool that we can do that there too, that we can not just think about it like watching on TV and seeing, okay, Australia already had theirs, now I'm waiting for mine. It's like you could actually be looking down at Earth and knowing Australia right now is celebrating New Year's Eve. And perhaps even if you got a really good camera, capture some of those, you know, fireworks or other lights that are going on, which is kind of cool.
Well, Nicole, as we head into the new year, when it comes to space exploration, what are you most excited for in 2026?
Wow, I'm excited for these public-private partnerships to keep going and, you know, to help us maintain that continued human presence in low Earth orbit. And I'm super excited for Artemis II. I cannot wait to see our friends launch on their way to the moon and, you know, selfishly send back some of that imagery that I'm so hopeful for that they'll be seeing with their own eyes and, you know, leading us to that presence that I think we really deserve and that life on Earth deserves for us getting back to the moon. I'm so excited for that. And I'm really hopeful that there will be more and more opportunities for us to better understand all the ways that space is helping benefit life on Earth. I mean, the ultimate goal of why we do this thing, and to be bringing that to light in more ways in 2026.
So, Nicole, you're going to be at the Orlando Science Center. What's bringing you to town?
Well, we have, in partnership with the Orlando Science Center, the Space for Art Foundation and Space for a Better World have curated a really incredible Space for Art exhibit in the Fusion Steam Gallery there. And we have one, the Beyond Art Spacesuit, and then some incredible artwork by astronauts and amazingly talented artists that's on display in that gallery. And we've got a number of different events that we're going to be participating in throughout the next, I think it runs through April.
Nicole Stott, astronaut, aquanaut, and artist. Thanks so much for joining us and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Still to come, searching for faraway worlds with a brand new telescope.
And your mind may be going to the fact that, wow, it sounds like you might be able to directly image planets around that star. And that's exactly what the goals are of this instrument.
A look at how NASA's Roman Space Telescope will bring fresh eyes to the galaxy. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA. Designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries, beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/spacemba.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. As we end 2025, we are looking back on some of our space reading recommendations. From how one former NASA astronaut views the world to how space pirates could be a real thing, we'll give two books another spin next time on Are We There Yet? But for now, we are talking about the Roman Space Telescope. NASA's officially finished building the giant telescope. Roman will scan our skies for things like exoplanets and even search for dark energy and dark matter in our universe. It's designed for large-scale surveys and can observe hundreds of millions, if not billions, of objects in space, beaming back roughly a terabyte of data each day. Here to talk more about this powerful telescope is Joshua Schlieder, a deputy senior project scientist for NASA's Roman Space Telescope. Josh, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Hey, great to chat with you about the Roman Space Telescope, which has hit a very critical milestone. But before we jump into that, take us back. What is the Roman Space Telescope and what does it aim to do?
The Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope is NASA's next large strategic astrophysics mission. This mission follows in the footsteps of previous large missions like the Hubble Space Telescope, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, the James Webb Space Telescope, etc. And it builds on the legacy of those missions to tackle new and previously unsolved mysteries in the cosmos. Roman is designed first and foremost to be a large-scale survey observatory. It does have a secondary instrument, which I'll speak to in a bit, that is designed for targeted observations of individual sources. But the primary instrument, its wide-field imaging camera, is designed for large-scale surveys of our universe at infrared wavelengths, which are wavelengths that are at slightly longer wavelengths than the human eye is sensitive to. And in doing so, it will observe via large surveys hundreds of millions to billions of galaxies, tens of thousands of exploding stars known as Type 1A supernovae, hundreds of millions to billions of stars inside of our own galaxy to understand the stellar populations and their properties and also search for exoplanets around those stars. And in the process of doing so, observe innumerable numbers of other kinds of astronomical objects that are waiting to be observed. Unlike its predecessors at similar wavelength range, Hubble and JWST, Roman is not designed for targeted individual observations in its primary science. It is designed for large-scale surveys where it's going to be taking imaging and spectroscopy of very large numbers of astronomical objects over large areas of the sky. We have a second instrument on Roman. It is a technology demonstration instrument. We call it the coronagraph. And it is designed to demonstrate new technologies that have never before been flown in space that will allow us to block out the light of a bright star and beat down the noise in the optical system in the observatory so that we can detect extremely faint objects in the vicinity of that star. And your mind may be going to the fact that, wow, it sounds like you might be able to directly image planets around that star. And that's exactly what the goals are of this instrument.
That's cool. In doing so, what questions will the Roman Space Telescope help scientists like yourself answer?
Roman focuses on three core science topics. We will perform three large surveys that have been defined over a period of several years by about 1,000 people in the science community to tackle two primary open questions in astrophysics. The first open question is, what is driving the accelerating expansion of our universe over time? And how does whatever is driving it sort of govern the evolution of our universe? We have a name for this. We call it dark energy. There's also dark matter in the mix. Roman will tackle questions in addressing the nature of dark energy and the distribution of dark matter in our universe by performing two core surveys. The first one will be looking at very large numbers of galaxies spread across the sky. It will directly detect and collect data so we can analyze the properties of hundreds of millions of galaxies. And in doing so, we'll measure their distances and their velocities. We'll measure their shapes to very high precision. Another thing that we'll do is we'll use the Wide Field Instrument's large field of view to repeatedly visit the same patch of sky and search for a particular type of exploding star called a Type 1A supernova. Type 1A supernovae are very interesting because they result from a white dwarf, which is the leftover core of a star like our sun, that is in a binary with another star, and it is accreting material from that other star and gaining mass. And as it gains mass, it reaches a certain threshold, and it will ultimately explode in a thermonuclear detonation. That detonation we see as a supernova, these white dwarfs. They can act as standardizable candles. They effectively can be treated as a 100-watt light bulb. And if you know it's a 100-watt light bulb and you know how bright it is, then you can estimate its distance. And you can make other measurements like its velocity, et cetera. And that gives you additional handle from a completely different observing perspective on the acceleration of our universe over time, which gives you a handle on the influence of dark energy and how it's sculpting the evolution of our universe. And that other survey, which we call a time domain survey, because we're observing the same patch of sky repeatedly to look for these type 1A supernovae and monitor how they brighten and then how they dim over time. Those two surveys both are tackling these questions about dark energy primarily, and then also dark matter from two different angles. So we can compare those results and sort of narrow in on what is the true nature of dark energy and how is it driving the accelerated expansion of our universe. Completely separate from that, we have another large survey where we'll be turning Roman's large field of view toward several patches of sky near the center of our galaxy where there's a very, very large number of stars. We'll be visiting in sort of a continued pattern of field, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and just keep going around to those different locations and obtaining brightness measurements of some 200 million stars inside of our own galaxy. This survey is primarily designed to detect a signature called gravitational microlensing, where if you have a star closer to us that passes in front of a star further in the distance, the gravity from the foreground star will magnify the light of the background star, because when you have mass in space-time, it bends the fabric of space-time and it acts as a lens. If there's a star, it passes in front of a background star, it lenses it, it gets brighter. We see that brightness change in the light curve. If the foreground star also hosts a planet at a particular range of separations, the gravity of that planet can act as an additional magnification, and you get another characteristic bump in the brightening of the light curve. This survey we're planning to do toward the core of our galaxy will yield some 1,000 planets via microlensing detections, which will help us fill in what we call the demographics, or what kinds of planets orbit what kinds of stars at what separations in a range of separation that we currently have very little handle on. And we expect, given the density of stars we're observing, some 200 million, and the sensitivity of the observatory, we'll detect somewhere around 100,000 transiting planets in this survey.
That's wild. That's a lot.
So you take our microlensing detections at wide separation or solar system scale separation, our transiting planet detections at much closer in separation where the transits are more common and have a higher likelihood of happening. And this single survey with Roman will sort of revolutionize our understanding from a statistical standpoint of the planets around other stars in our galaxy. That's the second thing, is this exoplanet demographic science. The third is what we call general astrophysics, which is all the other science that these surveys will deliver. So you can imagine, if you're observing a very large area of the sky to look at hundreds of millions of galaxies, you're observing the same patches of sky to search for these supernovae, and in the core of our galaxy to look for these exoplanets. There's lots of other stuff in those parts of the sky, and there's lots of other things that may be changing on the timescales that we're observing. And our general astrophysics, part of it is everything else that comes out of the data from those three large surveys. We've already planned one of those general astrophysics surveys. It will be looking toward the plane of our galaxy in the sky. So if you're in a very dark site, you look up at the night sky, you might see this sort of wispy, hazy stripe across the sky. That's because you're looking from, we're inside of the galactic plane, and we're looking in toward the core of the galaxy where there's a very high density of stars and dust. We're going to be using Roman to map out about 700 square degrees of our galactic plane. And sprinkled in there, there's going to be deep observation areas, there's going to be time domain observation areas, and this will be the deepest, highest resolution, multi-wavelength imaging survey of our galactic plane ever done. And just to give you one statistic quickly, we expect that we will resolve and individually detect and measure the brightness for some 20 billion stars in our own galaxy. That's about 1/5 of the stars in our own galaxy. And so what I'm trying to convey here is that Roman's core science and the general astrophysics science, it builds on what has come before, but it really is at a new scale.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. From Central Florida Public Media, I'm Brendan Byrne. We are speaking with Joshua Schlieder, Deputy Senior Project Scientist for NASA's Roman Space Telescope, about the telescope's capabilities. Josh, I'm just going to try to wrap my head around some of the things that you just told me there. The bending of space-time, the search for dark energy, dark matter, the mapping of the galactic plane. This all sounds like something in a science fiction novel, but it is actually happening because this telescope is built, right? It is ready to go. Tell me a bit about the milestone that it has reached.
We're now at a point where, over many years, this observatory has gone from ideas in the community to designs on paper to individual pieces of hardware to now being a fully built observatory. And the final two large portions of the observatory just got integrated together to make the complete observatory as of the end of November. And so it was a very exciting time. We now have a complete observatory. Those two large pieces that have now been put together are continuing to undergo their mechanical and electrical connections and doing various tests of those connections and the deployment of, you know, things like the solar panels, et cetera, that have to open up in space. And that's all going now. And then after the holiday season, the full observatory will be moving forward into a vibration test where we take the full observatory, we put it on a specialized, very large table that will shake it, and it will simulate the vibration environment that it experiences during launch to make sure it can make it through that environment. Then we'll come back off the shake table, as we call it, go through a bunch of post-vibration testing, including, you know, checking out all the alignment and electrical connections, and then also doing some optics checkouts of our telescope, et cetera. And then we'll be heading toward getting ready to go to the launch site. And so this is all coming together after years and years of work and the effort of, I will say, thousands of extremely dedicated scientists, engineers, technicians, managers, and everyone in between. And it really is a gigantic human effort.
It's a space-based telescope. You mentioned you're moving towards launch. The testing simulates, you know, the forces that it will be on top of that rocket. How will it leave this planet? What rocket will send it off this planet? And where is it going?
Roman will be launching on top of a SpaceX Falcon Heavy from Kennedy Space Center, Cape Canaveral. Once it's launched, it will be heading toward a point in space called the Sun-Earth L2 Lagrange point. This is a point in space that is about 1 million miles out from the Earth. And it's where sort of the gravitational forces of the sun and the Earth sort of reach a balance. That orbit is really critical for Roman's core survey science, because if we were in low Earth orbit and we were being eclipsed, you know, we were going around the Earth and the Earth was getting in the way every 90 minutes, we would not be near as efficient at doing large scale surveys, and achieving this next generation science would just not be possible.
Finally, Josh, once Roman launches and it checks out and begins making those observations, what are you personally most excited about from those first observations you're going to get back?
It's hard to pick. I could dive into, you know, my science background, stars, exoplanets, all of the great things we'll do with that, which will be super exciting. But I think what's most exciting to me about Roman is that the depth and scale of its observations compared to what we've previously done mean that just looking at the statistics, that we'll have thousands of objects in our data that are 1 in a million that we have never seen before. We're going to find things we just didn't expect. And I think that some of those will be the most exciting discoveries that come from this observatory.
And I hope you'll join me to talk about those surprises you get from the Roman Space Telescope. We've been speaking with Josh Schlieder. He's the Deputy Senior Project Scientist on NASA's Roman Space Telescope. Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetherey@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.